find some spot. I'm probably going to stand over here. Welcome, everyone. My name is Todd Landstad. I'm a program manager within Windows, and may have seen our session yesterday, but just do a quick introduction that I end up working with a number of partners, media-focused partners in our ecosystem, building Windows Store apps. And I have the pleasure of working with these guys a bunch on their different projects. In planning for Build, you know, we looked at the number of sessions that we were covering and really wanted to provide some great insight and experiences from people who have built apps for folks like you. You may have already been building your apps, or you might be in the process of building it, or you might be in the planning of building your apps. I heard from some of the audience earlier, there are some decisions that some folks are making about how they create their applications, and I think that this session and hearing from these guys is going to be quite interesting for all of you, both in the audience and online. What the format is, I'll go ahead and do a quick intro of everyone, and then we'll jump into questions. For the majority of the session, and we'll leave a few minutes at the end of the session for questions that you might have. So as you listen to their experiences, keep thinking about those and hop up to a microphone. In the background, you might see the slides of the bios of everyone, but let me go ahead and do a quick intro and see if I can remember everyone's pronunciation of their names. But Zachary Pinter from Hulu Plus, Ilya Hakenson, also from Hulu Plus, both developers on their current app. We've got Andrew Cowart from Slacker Radio, and Carl Sobeski, also from Slacker Radio, both developers on the Slacker Radio app. And then next to them is Eli Tamanaha, and I almost had it. Tamanaha, thank you very much. I did practice that. Eli Tamanaha, wow. Matt Arnold, happily has an easier name to pronounce. Matt Arnold and Eli both worked on the Netflix application that we're all probably using as well. And then next to them, we've got some Microsoft folks that were in the driving the media extension session yesterday. Richard Fricks, Matt Howard, and Marcin, now known as Marty Stankovic. Marcin Stankovic, all developers on the media platform, and Richard being a program manager. And so what we'll do is let's go ahead and kind of jump right into questions. I'm going to start with Zachary. And Zachary, you know, if you haven't, or the Hulu Plus application has some pretty unique UX and design to it. I wanted to understand a little bit about, and actually maybe I'll point it to Ilya first, about some of the decisions that you went and had in creating your Hulu Plus app and bringing that to Windows 8.
Sure. So we actually started the process of working on our Windows 8 app in early May of this year, and we looked at the platform, and we really wanted to bring the best kind of experience to that platform. And certainly, we have an experience in the web browser already with a Flash-based player, and we wanted to bring something that utilized the kind of the native experience that the Metro UI provides, both the touch aspect of it as well as the I guess the layout language and the UI language that that framework adheres to and prefers really works very, very well with the kind of design aesthetic that we have at Hulu. In addition, we just really wanted to provide a smooth native experience on the platform. And so we kind of looked around and figured out that this was something that we could easily do on Windows 8. And that's how we started.
Cool. One thing I failed to ask, I wanted to give, in your words, kind of give me a little intro of yourself and some of the background and the focus that you have for working on the project.
Sure, yeah. I'll start and then I'll let Zachary do it as well. My role at Hulu is I'm the director of software development on the mobile side of things, under which the Windows platform falls. My role in this particular project was to help coordinate some of the kind of the end-to-end aspect of launching this and working with the rest of the team to do so.
Mm-hmm. And Zachary, yeah, go ahead and introduce yourself, and then I'll ask you a couple of questions.
Sure. So I'm a software developer on Hulu's mobile team. I started there a little over a year ago. And I've had some experience in the past working with WPF and with Silverlight and Windows Phone 7. So coming on board, or when this project came up, I joined it, and it was good. I'm trying to set up a lot of the architecture and the UI, and having some familiarity with that in the past helped.
With the, you mentioned the UI and the user experience design. There are a number of things that we've talked about in build around contracts, searching, sharing, and the overall UI design of the apps. What kind of experiences did you have in thinking about maybe how to lay out your application?
Sure. So one of the things we do for all of our applications, generally on the mobile side, is we don't make a TV page and a movie page and a search page. We tend to make more generic pages, like a horizontally scrolling page. And then that lets us drive almost all of the content on each page through server-side changes. So that alone has been really helpful for us, where we can rearrange and redesign a lot of the architecture of our application, the information architecture, without having to release a new build. So that's been one pattern that works really well, and then we just create a handful of templates that we can mix and match as we need to. And then for actually creating those templates, we have a really strong design team, and combine that with like just overriding control templates in XAML, we were able to have a lot of sessions where we just sit down with the designers and say, oh, can you move this over, or can we try that out? Let's see what that looks like. Let's move the opacity up a bit here.
Cool. And you just mentioned, so, and it's one of my questions, is the technology choice. So you guys have used XAML, C#, and choice in your application. With the hub design, one of the things, and we're after each one of the apps, and after we discuss them, we'll have each of the members of the panel demo the app so that we can get a little bit of better feel for the visuals. But one of the things in Hulu Plus I wanted to mention is the visual variation. We talk about a lot of in the design of having different sized items that draw a customer's eye, draws the viewer's eye to different places. You guys, how did you choose to lay out that hub?
Sure. So again, like I said, with the server-side layouts, we can actually rearrange that as we need to. So if we have a piece of content that we really want to promote, we might set it as first two tiles big. Whereas if it's just a more minor thing, we'll say, oh, do 16 thumbnails here.
So you're controlling that from the server side into the feed of the application so you can dynamically change it?
Exactly. Now, in order to do that, we had to take a few variations from the standard grid view approach with the application. So we use more of a virtualizing stack panel, items control, and then we fit in whatever section we want on that content. So some of the trade-offs with that has been, when it comes to semantic zoom, there's a few issues with that right now. That said, even after the talks today, we've got another trick that we can try that should be able to re-implement the semantic zoom in a nice fluid way with our items control approach.
Cool. Yeah, you were mentioning that there was another talk that was giving you some good tips about using semantic zoom.
Yeah, the list view talk. I'm sure the video will be up soon, but that was a little bit earlier today and really interesting.
Very cool. So on the technology questions, maybe I'll switch over to Ilya for a moment. I wanted to ask about the content delivery choices that Hulu Plus is chosen for the Windows 8 app, and tell us about a little bit about the frameworks that you used and other SDKs to build the app.
Certainly. So there are really three components to our content delivery system. There's the choice of streaming technology, so how do we deliver the bits. There's a choice of protection technologies, DRM, and there's kind of a choice of how we develop the player side, so the client side of the player. And each of those was a choice that we worked fairly closely with Microsoft to make. On the rights management side, we worked with Microsoft to enable PlayReady, which is pretty much the best way for us to guarantee a secure content path on Windows 8 devices. Once you choose that, then the next logical choice, and one that we thought was actually going to provide the best streaming experience and best quality for the user, would be the smooth streaming or adaptive Microsoft adaptive support. So we've integrated with that as well, and we have a content packaging step that works on our backend to appropriately take a number of different initial bit rates in which our video is encoded and then package them for streaming using smooth streaming. Finally, on the client side, we looked at different ways of implementing the player. And one thing that's very tricky, you know, on all of the platforms for Hulu is that, as some of you may know, we not only stream videos, but we perform ad insertion in the videos. And most of our videos are ad-supported, both with pre-rolls, mid-rolls, and post-rolls in certain cases. And that means that we need to be very cognizant of performance. We need to make sure that users are not going to be left buffering for 15 seconds after an ad or before an ad or whatnot, even in poor network conditions. So we had to make a good choice, and we chose an open source project which is part of the Microsoft Media Platform called I think it's just called Player Framework.
Player Framework.
It's a relative of the Silverlight Media Framework, and it's actually been a great platform for us. It's an open source project, so we can look at the underlying code, and we've worked fairly closely with the maintainers of that project as well to make it fit our needs and to make sure that it supports both obvious things like ad insertion as well as more niche features like closed captioning using the TTML format for captions.
Mm-hmm. Great. And that's the player framework. We saw that in a session yesterday. But were there any challenges that you ran into with that, or accelerators, both on the positive and challenging
sure,
side?
Sure. Yeah. So well, Windows. We launched our app a couple of days before Windows went live, and clearly, when working with any platform that's under development, a lot of things are changing, both in your own understanding of the platform as well as in the platform itself. And so, we certainly had to work through both. A way to understand how the platform fits together within our ecosystem, as well as sometimes we'd run into problems and we'd have to go work with someone at Microsoft who, on the smooth streaming side or on the player framework side to, for example, deal with the algorithms for smooth streaming upgrades or downgrades in quality or help resolve some of the questions that we had or some of the particular situations we're into with ad insertion. Most of them, honestly, most of the complexity is related to our ad insertion aspect. And we found that the player framework, as you know, we got at the point that it is now, behaves really, really well for our kinds of needs.
Cool. Maybe a question around the UI for Zachary. The secondary tiles is something that we see with Hulu Plus. Can you talk about either technically on how you implemented it and then what it means for a Hulu Plus user?
Sure. So the default API with secondary tiles is pretty straightforward in that you pass it a URL for an image and you give it a little bit of extra data and you can pin it to the start, which is great. One catch with that, or something that we have to be careful of, is that you can't really control a lot of what the image looks like, right? Like, we want to put a show on the start screen, but we want to still have it visibly recognized as a Hulu show, not just the show artwork. So part of the work there is that we have to actually compose an image. We could do it client or server side. I believe at the moment we're doing it client side, where we take the actual show artwork and we also blip on our logo to the side of it. So that one's not quite as obvious, and there's not as much fluidity in the APIs yet to do something like that to combine images. But the approach we have works just fine.
And hopefully folks have tried the secondary tiles, but I wanted to mention that it's a way to get into the app kind of through a side door, through down to a series level or a particular show.
Exactly. You can click on, or you can say, I want Fringe saved to my start screen. And then anytime you want, you can click on that icon and it'll go straight to the Fringe show page instead of going first to the home page or anything like that.
Cool.
One of the things we're actually looking forward to working on soon is adding in the live tile support to that as well, so that we can actually flip through and you can see visibly on your start page if there is a new Fringe episode instead of just having it always the same image.
Cool.
So
cool.
Should
Great.
Be interesting.
Great. So thanks for that insight. I think what we'll maybe do is have either or both of you take a quick tour through the Hulu Plus app and demo it for folks. I'm just going to walk back and help. Okay, and we'll switch over.
As you guys can see, we've implemented live tiles for our print, for our main tile. Our application upon startup, as Zachary was saying, is it's a server-supported application, so we're pulling a lot of its layout dynamically from the servers. We've implemented both a featured section, so you can see what's featured in the application, as well as a number of sections throughout the rest of the main page that are sometimes editorially driven, sometimes programmatically driven. And you can see both the variation in layout as well as in functionality between different areas. As an example, this control over here allows vertical swiping or control. We have to do a little bit of work initially to make sure that it's put on rails so that user can't swipe left and right while they're flipping vertically. And in general, this application allows both presentation on this kind of level as well as a deeper dive into content. So for example, here's one show, and here you can see the different seasons of this show and the episodes within them. There is an app bar, both a bottom app bar that shows a little bit of additional detail, as well as a top app bar that allows some high-level navigation across the different sections within the application. And obviously, there's playback as well within the application.
You're not even here anymore.
But it's
one of the things that
we
had to work with, we were fairly excited to work with, was the capability of performing a snap view within the application. So not only can you work on things, not only can you watch video, but you can work on other things while doing it. Coming back to the application, one other thing I wanted to show is that is kind of this pinning thing that we were talking about. Actually, that's a video. So let's say I want to pin a show, so I can say pin, and then some sort of a tile appears. If I pin it to the start menu, then somewhere in the start will be a Hulu icon tile, and if you tap on that, then you'd go straight to the bonus show.
Great, thanks, Ilya.
Sure.
So I'm going to hand the microphones down the line. We're going to switch modes a little bit and talk a little bit about music streaming and really look at some of the aspects that Slacker Radio had when creating their application. I'm going to start with Andrew Cowart. Andrew, why don't you give us a little bit of a, in your own words, bio to let us know what you do.
Sure. So I'm an application developer at Slacker Radio. I was involved with the BlackBerry, Windows Phone, Windows 8, and the upcoming Xbox app for Slacker Radio. And the Xbox app, look forward in the next few months.
Cool. We met probably quite a few months ago now, and one of the things that we spoke about was your past work on other platforms, and WinPhone 7 was one of them. Can you talk a little bit about the technology decision that you had in building your Win 8 app? Which direction did you go, and kind of how did any of the past work influence that decision?
So really last year, after the build conference and the developer preview of Windows 8 was released, I thought, wow, that's really cool. So I went and got a Windows 7 tablet, and I installed the developer preview. And actually, that same night that I bought the tablet, I installed the development tools. And within about 4 to 6 hours, I was able to have a fully working Slacker prototype. So it had the ability to log in. You could view the entire station list. You could play any station. And it had a now playing screen, so you could use the transport controls and all that. And that was really possible because of our existing Windows Phone 7 Slacker Radio application. So both applications are written in C# and XAML. And we're really able to reuse a lot of the service logic, so all the parsers, all the object models. Even some of the UI was very similar and able to be reused and copied quickly.
Mm-hmm. Cool. That was you were one of my quotes in the early months because of how quickly you told me that you were able to prototype stuff. It was pretty fast. And so that meant you didn't need to make very many server-side changes, just to hook up to existing services?
Yeah, so server-side, nothing changed. We were able to reuse all the same services we used for the Windows Phone 7 app. And it was great to come into work the next day, and I kind of showed that to the boss, and I was like, here's our Windows 8 app prototype. What do you think? Should we go for it? And that's so, yeah, cool. Here we are today.
Cool. And I know it wasn't always rosy, because I talked to Carl a lot as well, and especially on prototype hardware, working with audio, doing background audio. We talked about yesterday how important it is to be able to listen to my music and do other stuff. So I'm going to ask Carl a little bit. So Carl, actually tell us a little bit about what you do.
Okay, I'm also an application developer at Slacker. I've been doing audio applications since the late 90s, since the very beginning of MP3 stuff, so I've been doing this a long time.
Yeah.
And I was brought in to work on to finish up the Slacker Radio app for Windows 8.
So you guys had the privilege of going through some early app submissions, as did all three of these subjects, and learning along the way as we created the platform before it was released. Background audio has a few components we've talked about before, but transport controls and hardware events. Can you tell a little bit about the use of the media control object, and how was that easy, hard? What did that give you?
Yeah, the media control, that's the system control that pops up when you hit some of the hardware transport buttons, like, you know, volume or the the play and
play, pause, yeah, next, previous.
So to hook up to that is very easy. So you set the track name and the artist name. It's just properties on that control that you set. To set the album art, you just have to download. We download our own album art, so we need to download that album art to a file, temporary file.
Yeah.
Very straightforward, and then just set the image to the.
Did you have to do any photo manipulation for that album art? Like, what kind of?
No, we don't do any. You know, so it's just a straight download.
And it's just a square image that you end up using for that album art.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. There was one thing. For example, if you're downloading to a temporary file, you know, the one challenge you run into is that if you already set the album art to something on the media control, then you're downloading. You have to download to a different file, obviously, right? Because you'll get a protection vault if you try to do that. So it's that's a little tricky just to manage the two files, but that's no big deal.
What about setting, so playing audio, setting a source to a URL that's an asset that's available to me, an MP3 or something like that, pretty straightforward in our samples. Can you tell us a little bit about the background audio support?
Yeah, so there's two parts of the background audio. The first part's really easy. So with background audio, the first scenario is, you're playing audio, and then the user either launches another application or switches another application into the foreground, and you go to the background. If you don't do anything and you're using the media element, your audio is going to stop. It's going to stop playback. So there's like four things you need to do, right? You talked about it yesterday. You set the audio category, the background. There's something in there.
This is a quiz, including asking your experience.
Great.
Yeah. You don't have to go through them all.
Okay. And so that works. When you get all that, that was very easy.
Yeah.
The second tier is something called connected standby. And this is a new system state that was introduced with Windows 8.
Yeah.
We're typically used to, sleep and hibernate as these low power states, and in those states everything stops. But a connected standby, it's this new state where the user taps the power button, the screen goes off, but things are still running in the background, right? But the network pipe shuts off, right? So the problem is, with Slacker, we're using the media element, so we need to make a network connection to get the URL for the next track when we get the track or the media ended event. The problem is that there's no more. The network's gone. So how do you do that, right? So that was the main challenge that we had to overcome, and we didn't have any hardware that supported this connected standby, because this isn't supported on every hardware out there. It's only on the newer tablets.
Right.
And if you're interested, there's a utility you could run. I think it's called Power Config or Power CFG in System 32. Right. That was a big help to determine whether or not the device supports this.
Right.
So the solution was, well, what I found out was it was the media element itself that was keeping the network pipe alive. So when you set the source property to a URL, of course, it would have to open up the network pipe and make the connection and start downloading and streaming the music. It was then you knew that, okay, now the network is alive, I can make my web request and it'll work. But then again, you can't use the normal HTTP client class. You have to use a new something called background transfer. So that was a little, there was some work involved there because that doesn't manage cookies. And all our web requests require cookies and stuff. So I had to do my own cookie parsing and setting the cookies and everything based on that.
Mm-hmm.
But as you can imagine, so basically the way it would work is that, we would always request one URL ahead of time. So when we got the media ended event, it was already there. We'd set it to the source. We'd get the event that it's playing. Now we know that the network's alive. We can make the request for the next one.
Yeah.
There was also another tricky thing that if you set source and you call play, because it hasn't downloaded the new track yet, it would actually start playing the previous one until it had enough buffer for the new one. Then it would start playing the new one. So that wouldn't work. So I figured out if we set autoplay and don't use play, that was way around that.
Cool.
The other thing is that what I found out was that when you're in this connected standby state, everything is really slow. Your app is throttled, right? And you have about 20 to 30 seconds before the audio ends, before the OS will suspend your app. Because that's the thing. So when you're a background audio app, the only thing that keeps your app alive and running and not being suspended is because you're playing audio. Once the audio stops, you have about 30 seconds to start playing audio again. If you don't, then you're gone, right? So so the big thing is, you don't want to do anything else except play audio and maybe make a web request for the next URL and maybe for the album art.
So be quick about
the, yeah. Because what was happening was I was still doing all my UI updates because in the Slacker app, for example, we download lyrics and things like that. So I was still making all these web requests, and they were just taking really, really long time. And what would happen is, on short tracks, you would time out, and we get put to sleep.
Intercondition, right? Yeah. So then you get suspended, and you're not able to play that next track.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, getting rid of all the extra UI stuff, which you shouldn't be doing anyway, because you're just wasting the user's battery. Now, the interesting thing is you don't really know when you're in a connected standby state. There's no API to tell you that you're in this state. The only thing that's available to you, there's a window visibility state on the, mm-hmm. on the window that you can register for this event to tell you when your visibility has changed. So that's why we still have to set the album arc, because we could just be running in the background and not in connected standby, and in which case, when the user clicks on the volume and the media control comes up, you still want to see the album art.
Yeah.
Right. So we're still making that album art call, even though maybe in connected standby we don't have to. But it's
so it seems like there's a good tip there. Then, if you're in that background audio state, to really reduce what kind of UI updates that you're making.
Right. We don't do any anymore. Right.
Yeah. 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 To save on that time, I'm going to throw out a related question around streaming audio, and it's not directly at you guys. I'm actually going to pull in the Microsoft guys as an impromptu question around Shoutcast. One of the questions we get often is, does our media platform support a Shoutcast live stream, and how does that work? And maybe Richard, you could talk
So we do have some support for Shoutcast streams, but in the case that you're particularly speaking to, there was additional metadata that needed to be pulled from the Shoutcast stream that we did not have support mm-hmm. for.
And just to make sure, the first part, though, if someone wants to play a Shoutcast stream, what do they need to do? It just ends up working.
Right. So in this particular case, and you guys chime in too, are you familiar with the Shoutcast, the stream parsing that would go on to pull the Shoutcast stream out, and how to pull that data? You might know more details of how you actually can query that data from the parser.
Sure. Yeah. I can speak a little bit to that. I may be wrong, but I believe that when you can just pass in a URL to a Shoutcast stream, and we will actually just play it. However, you may not get the metadata, so you may not see the artist and the other metadata like that. The HTTP stream object that we support underneath doesn't expose ways to query for extra headers. So all the like the IC metadata headers that you'd want to get, those aren't available through our inbox HTTP byte stream. Now, you don't necessarily have to use our inbox byte stream. You can go and implement your own and then get access to some of the headers that way. But obviously, it's a little more work.
Mm-hmm. So the basic support is there, but some of the advanced metadata, just because it's a related streaming music scenario, I wanted to get some feedback from you guys on that.
Right, yeah, and so in the case that you mentioned, so what they did, because they wanted some of the metadata that we support, the basic metadata that's defined in the specification, but in the case that you mentioned, there was additional metadata that they wanted that we didn't expose. So they did write their own handler that actually parsed that stream themselves and pulled that data out, and then using the property set mechanism was able to pass that information up to their application so that they could display the additional metadata.
Yeah, cool. And that's a question that we get fairly often, so thank you for answering that. So Carl or Andrew, I'll maybe invite you up to the podium and do a quick demo of the Slacker radio application if people haven't seen it before.
Okay, so if you're not familiar with Slacker Radio, basically it's a internet radio service. There's different tiers. We support on-demand playback, although the on-demand stuff isn't in this app yet. We also support caching, which isn't in this yet, but that stuff is coming. So basically, what we have here is basic radio playback. So on the top screen. We basically have different groups here. These are Slacker Spotlight stations. Now, what's different about Slacker is that we have real people behind these, programming these radio stations. So, for example, the stormy weather and Halloween, all these stations were programmed by real people. And of course, we have 34 genre stations over genre categories over 200 stations. And we also have talk, news, and sports, ESPN Radio, ABC News, and we also have comedy. So I'm just going to, drill in here. These are all the different genres, right? So this can, it's a huge list. So, we support semantic zoom. So, for example, if I wanted to check out some of the music festival stations, I just, go here. And if I wanted to, play one. All right, so... So I'm listening to this station. If I really like this station, I can do a deep link to it. I can do a pin station, right? And of course that just pins it to the the start screen. So it's I've been trying to do it right. There it is. So if I, that would bring it back.
Why don't you go ahead and change the volume on that so we can show the transport controls.
So right, so there, you see the metadata, and you see the, you see the album. So show me family. It works, right? All the blood that I will bleed. And so we have artist bios. I don't know where I went wrong. Related artists, something you expect. And if you were a paid user, you'd see you'd see the lyrics, album reviews. I can go in and check out this is what I've recently played. If I play a few songs in the station, frozen into cars, white girls of the north, fire past one, fire one, they are the fable. It'll show the
recent songs you play. Yeah. One of the things I before we wrap up the demo, it's either for our Carl or Andrew, but searching for artists, you get a lot of artists on Slacker Radio, and you guys do a little bit of a unique thing with search.
Yeah. So you can search for. And You know, and this would work from from any time you bring up the search,
yeah,
the search bar, and you search, you type in a name and you hit Slacker, it'll show, and then it'll launch the
cool.
Launch the
and then creating a custom radio station for that artist as you choose them. So. Right. So you dive right into the music. Awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks for the demo, Carl. And we'll switch over to the third partner. And just as a reminder, after we finish going through with Netflix, we will open up some questions for the audience. So make sure you're remembering and thinking about those questions. And so start off... With Eli, and I'm going to ask first. Go ahead and give us a little background on you. And the question is around your UX decisions with Netflix. And we talk a lot about navigating through content and using category headers. And what was the approach that Netflix chose?
Okay, so my name is Eli Tamanaha. Work at Netflix. I've been working on this Windows 8 project for. Last 6 months or so, and I worked a lot on the UI stuff, writing mostly XAML and UI, or XAML and C#. And when it comes to like some of the UI navigation type decisions that we've made, it's really important for Netflix to get you to find the show that you really like. And so there's a number of things that we do that. For example, we want to show you as many box art pictures as we can, because we think that if people can see a lot of box art, then they'll be able to pick something that they like. And it's visually appealing as well. But more than that, when you look at our main grid view, and you see all those groups with all those box art pictures, there's a personalization algorithm that goes into it. And that's driven by the server. And so what's on your main browse page is different from like what's on my main browse page or what's on Matt's. It'll be like the top 12 action movies that we think you'll like, and the top 12 romantic comedies that we think you'll like. All of it's personalized. And then to take it further, to get you to help you find something that you like, we spent a lot of effort in navigation through the app. And this is where like Windows 8 really kind of fit us well. So you have that main grid view with all the groups and stuff like that, and each group is a genre. Type of movie that we have. In addition to that, we support the semantic zoom because there are so many genres out there. Semantic zoom allows you to go directly to the genre that you like. But further than that, we'll demo it later. But there's this red ribbon at the top, which is there when you click on it and it extends down. You can pick genres in the top 10 for you and things like that, and go directly to that genre page. But when you start panning across, that ribbon automatically disappears. So it fits in line with that content before Chrome philosophy.
Cool. And you mentioned a lot of content in the hub, being able to serve up that personalized content for me if I'm logged in. Any performance considerations or tips that you can give that you guys took advantage of?
Yeah, performance was an issue for us. We're all working on pretty high-powered machines. And then when we first started getting the ARM devices, we noticed that like on the main browse page, when you throw the screen across, it would start to disappear. It would take a little while for all the box art pictures to start appearing, to catch up. So scaling was a big factor for us. And something that we did to improve that was to limit the amount of pixel redraws that we do. So you can see like on the main browse page, you have all those box art pictures. Those before were composed of like a grid, some kind of container with a grid, maybe a border, and then the image that's on top of that. So it was like overlapping UI elements, which caused a number of pixel redraws. But to optimize that, we made it so that we would have like a placeholder container there. And then when the image was loaded, that's when we would collapse the container part so that it wouldn't be redrawn. It would just be the image after that. So that, because there's so many box art pictures on the screen at the same time, that helped us out a lot. But in addition to that, like other performance considerations, it's really important for Netflix to get you to watch the entire movie, not just a portion of the movie, before your battery runs out. And so in order to do that, like you can optimize the GPU usage. And so we have this media element when the video is actually playing. But in order to optimize a GPU, you have to resize that media element to the bounds of the current window. So if you manually resize the media element to the current window, and then you collapse all of your other UI elements, then you get this huge bump in performance, where you're only using the GPU instead of the CPU at that point. And so that really drastically increases your battery performance.
Cool. Yeah, good battery life, more videos, more content. Matt Arnold, I wanted to ask a little bit related question around a visual state helper or a custom visual state helper that you guys created with the ribbon, and maybe introduce yourself first.
Sure. I'm Matt Arnold, a software developer at Netflix. Like Eli, we've both been working on the project for about the last 6 months, seems like all year. I focus mainly on video playback and some UI-related sort of underpinnings, metadata retrieval. Actually, do you want to take the question about the visual state? I think Eli might be better suited for that.
Okay. Yeah, so that ribbon that you see on the main page when you expand it and collapse it, that's all those items that are on that are dynamic. They're coming from the server. And we wanted to have a visual state that would collapse each of those elements with a specific animation. And then, of course, when you expand it, they reanimate back to their intended position. And so in order to populate a visual state, we programmatically, when those items come in from the server, we programmatically add the animation to the visual state for a ribbon open state or a ribbon closed state. And so in order to do that, we had a visual state helper to it that programmatically did all these things.
Cool. Matt, so one of the things that Netflix did, which is similar to the dev folks' talk yesterday, is extend our media platform for a proprietary custom format. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience? What were the motivations, and how did it go?
Sure. Well, those of you who may be Netflix users already have remembered that we've had a history on Windows. We first started streaming on Windows. That was actually 2007. It was actually an ActiveX control, sort of old school kind of thing. But Silverlight appeared on the scene, and we invested a lot of time in developing our heuristics and our own adaptive streaming algorithms in Silverlight and C#. And so when Windows 8 came along, we definitely wanted to take advantage of everything we'd already learned and, in the best case, be able to just reuse our existing code. And we're actually able to achieve that because we looked into the Windows 8 platform and found out what was similar to our Silverlight experience and what was new. And what we had to do was create a new Media Foundation extension that we would then interface back to our C# code. And we could actually use our existing C# algorithms in order to stream the data through the new Windows 8 Media Foundations and back to Media Element. And once we got back there, we actually had almost identical environment that we currently have still in our Silverlight player. So we have a lot of synergy between our existing work and experience and what we were able to achieve in Windows 8. Some parts of it were kind of interesting. The Media Foundation was a new sort of area for us to go into. But a lot of parts were accelerated because we already were able to use a lot of existing code. We had experience there. So overall, it was a pretty good experience because once we got through sort of hooking everything up, it worked really well.
Cool. Well, rights management is something that's important to everyone here. And in your case, can you tell us a little bit about the integration that you had with your custom media source and using PlayReady?
Yeah, so that was another area that we had to sort of learn about, but it's sort of half and half of a familiar area in terms of interacting with the media element and how the Silverlight media element used to deal with rights management and what we had to do in the new Windows 8 environment. We learned how to use the trusted input authority in the Media Foundation environment to make sure that our PlayReady integration was connected to our custom Media Foundation source that was providing the Netflix stream. And then in the C# code, which was great because it's right in our app, we handle the license requests and send them down to actually just answer requests from the media element asking for our license, for example, or to individualize the machine. And again, once we hooked up a few things, it worked really well. And in our app, we were able to, we actually use our own custom license server, so we go integrate with our own services in C#, which is a great place to be able to write that kind of high-level code. And that worked out well for us. We were able to, like I said, take a lot of the stuff we already had been used to doing in the Silverlight world, and it's almost identical in the Windows 8 world, at least how we're using it.
Okay, Great. So when you mentioned diving deep into that media source code, error messages become and quality of service becomes very important to again all of you. Can you tell us a little bit about that path, working with us and how that evolved, and welcome the Microsoft people to jump in as well.
Yeah. So initially, of course, we got things working. That was great. We jumped up and down, actually played. But as things go with a new system, things would go wrong. And initially, we would get a lot of just sort of like unknown error type messages. Or we didn't even know what the problem was. There's actually levels of problems that can happen. The media element itself, if some of you have used it, know that it has like a media failed event that gives a nice string to show the user. But we needed a programmatic sort of piece of information to help us diagnose the problem in the field, because sometimes the message will be, we're an international company, and the message can't be, we can't use the message in different languages. We have to have a code. So we worked with Microsoft to get a H result put into the results so that we could see what the actual underlying problem was in the media element. And that helps us a great deal, because we actually log that information and we backhaul it to our systems, and we can get like a breakdown of what errors are happening. And that, I imagine, as we roll out further to more and more Windows 8 customers, we'll be able to more quickly diagnose problems that might be happening as they try to play.
Cool. That's great. So why don't we go ahead and do a demo of the app. Switch over here.
Okay, so here's a Netflix app right here. Because Todd is logged in, you can see the live tile. It's flipping his top five. Continue watching.
Everyone's going to know what I watch all the time. Walking Dead and Doctor Who. That's all I need. Oh, we've got the, go ahead and close. We've got some stormy weather in the background from Slacker.
Okay, so as we were talking about before, this is our main browse page, and you see this red ribbon right here. It's there for your navigation. Navigation is a big deal to us. You can make it collapse by just panning across, or you can manually expand it or collapse it like this. And I don't know if it matters much to the rest of you, but it mattered a big deal to me, in that each of these items right here in the ribbon animates to a separate location individually, and they fade out too. Anyways. So you can click on these ribbon items here to go to, for example, new releases. It takes you to an entire page with that genre or that group. In addition, like from here, you can see all of the, each group is a separate genre. Feel good, romantic, opposites attract, comedies, right here. So I've got 12 of them here. I can look at each group like that. In addition, to help with navigation, you can do semantic zoom. And so this is what this looks like. Each of these box art images that you see in each group here is actually what is represented in that group. So if I go here, that's exactly what you would see here because you watched Burn Notice. I don't know if you noticed it. But we're dynamically populating all the images that appear here in the semantic zoom. If you find something like a movie that you want to watch, like Ronin, this is our movie details page. You can read the synopsis. This is a scrolling area right here. Each of these actors and directors and genres is also a button that you can click on. You can see all the movies by Robert De Niro, for example, or go back, or the director. And let's see. Do you want to show Snap View?
Sure. So of course, like a good Windows 8 app does, we support Snap View. So we actually had to implement different view states for each of the, or we implemented Snap View different view states for each type of Snap View. And we support it on all our screens. And let me do one other thing that was kind of interesting. Our search experience, is very important for us to have sort of a dynamic search experience. Some of our other platforms, we try to echo what we do over there, which is as the user types, they will get results as they type live, which is maybe different from what some apps you may have seen do. we feel this is a very dynamic sort of gratification type of experience for the user when they're searching through what movies might be available. And just to quickly demo playback, or I don't think we've seen this screen yet. This is this what we call the show display page, where you might see all the episodes that belong to a show. And we have this long horizontal scrolling for all the episodes. And one thing we're considering maybe for the future is maybe also employing some kind of semantic zoom kind of feature here, where you might imagine zooming out and seeing all the seasons as an alternative to this drop-down that we currently use. And of course, playback, which is the main point of the whole app, is done with a media element. So that was, at the high level, very easy and familiar. And this is the mode in which Eli was talking about. This is the optimized video playback. And hopefully, you play many hours of Netflix this way and only need to see the Chrome when needed.
Great. Awesome. Thanks, you guys. I think we're going to turn it over to some audience questions. One point I wanted to make is I think we've covered so much with each of the apps is that every one of these apps does a great job of sharing as well and using that share charm. It's something we didn't demo, but all three do a fantastic job there. We'll go ahead and distribute the mics. And if we have, checking the time, we have almost 10 minutes left. So let's go ahead and see if there are any questions in the audience. Got one here. And if you could maybe, I'll try and paraphrase, but if you could try for the microphone, that'd be awesome.
Okay. So you guys are obviously downloading a lot of assets, which, especially in the Hulu and the Netflix case, came down with hardly any lag or delay. So this is kind of a two-part question. One is, what are the best practices for downloading a lot of assets when you need to, and how are you caching them? And secondly, when you're displaying all those visual assets, are you doing virtualization in the display to prevent drawing out of screen, and what techniques do you use around that? Thank you.
Sure. So at least in the case of our application, we played early on with maintaining our own cache of the images and downloading them manually and so on. But we actually found we got better performance and just generally good behavior by only setting the URI and letting the image component itself cache the image. And if you look on the drive or in some of the logging statements, you could see that there's some folder on your computer where it was actually taking every image component where you set the URI on it, it would download it to disk and it would refer to that if it's already there. So we were able to sidestep our whole implementation of the caching there and just rely on that, with the obvious caveat that we need to change our URI if we want to really be sure that the cache is going to get invalidated. So that's been one thing that works well for us. And your second part of the question?
Sorry, the second part was when it comes to having that many assets being drawn on the horizontal scroll, are you using like the virtualizing feature of the grid, or are you essentially setting all your image sources for the 100 or so images that are on your page and having it, I guess, draw in the background?
Sure.
I'm not as familiar with how WinRT does its drawing. I know in some older Windows technologies, if you were to create a form and put all these assets on it, it would draw the whole thing, whether or not it's visible or not. So If you could speak to that, that'd be great.
Sure. So somebody else can add in too, but at least how we do it, we have a virtualizing stack panel in the horizontal orientation, which covers that for us, where it doesn't load everything all at once. It's as you scroll, it creates those components. And then one thing that's actually been a little bit of a challenge for us that we need to do some more optimizations on in the ARM scene is we would almost like it to lazily create the items but then keep them there, where instead what we're seeing is that it will lazily create the items, but then if you scroll all the way to one side and scroll back, it has to recreate those. And if we can't lay out those components fast enough during that recreation, then we get a little bit of the blank screen. So there's some work for improvement there, but generally speaking, we get a lot better performance with the virtualizing stack panel than a regular stack panel.
As far as data loading goes, this would potentially apply to any platform, but we spent a long time or a lot of time making sure that our data loading was asynchronous, and we actually used a lot of the new async await features in the C# environment. But it also comes down to your how do you design your server client interaction. And something that's happening at Netflix quite recently is we've realized that there's tremendous advantage in reducing the number of server calls that you make to get the metadata. And this app, we worked really hard to reduce the number of server calls, in many cases down to one at startup, to actually get all the stuff you initially see. That's part of a protocol we came up with that we're using internally. But basically the principle is have a way that you can ask your server for exactly the data you need to show your screen. So it kind of boils down to there's no real magic, right? It's, if you've got an inefficient protocol, your app may take a long time to display as far as data loading. And the caching, our scheme happens to involve very sort of granular pieces of data. We're caching sort of stuff that's named with its sort of path within our virtual sort of internal database in the app. So that's the approach we used, and we're able to run that in the background through the async await and do it in sort of a very granular way. And so we only load what you're sort of seeing as the screens load. That's sort of our solution to that.
Great. Awesome. Another question up here. You want to go ahead and grab the mic? Go for it. I want to make you walk over there. It'll be a little better. Thank you.
Gentlemen, those are three lovely looking apps, really unique from a UI and graphic standpoint. I was really curious, there was a lot of innovation there from the UI, the ribbon, how you used application bars, how some of the tiles were laid out. I was curious in the project plan, how for each of you, how long did you have for the design process? And was it all kind of thought of and designed up front and then you implemented, or how many things kind of came up or were invented even by yourselves during development to make it that much more beautiful and a richer experience?
I guess I can start. We had an original, what we called MVP, or minimal viable product application, where we wanted to get something that looked good, but we didn't implement necessarily all the features. Our snap view didn't look as good as it should, things like that. And that we did in about 3 months' time. It was just to get it out there and get it preloaded on devices. But after that, we started working like heavily with the design team just on iterating on top of that particular version. And it wasn't all perfectly designed up front. Like, we had, I think, a couple different variations of the top navigation. Did we want to just show a few high-level links, or did we want to include a bunch of navigation items to make it easier to browse around? We also had similar things with our search results page, where we had a rather standard like grid search results that just showed a bunch of items in line, but we didn't really like the way that felt at the end of the day, so we went and looked with the new search APIs that our website is using. We were able to get a lot more data like editorials, so if you search for family, we'll get a list of family pics as well as modern family and things like that. So it's been a bit of both. We had a really good design up front, but we've done several iterations on things like our search results and our top app bars and things like that.
So with Slacker Radio, we actually partnered with Cypress Consulting. And Cypress is a company that works very closely with Microsoft to come up with our initial design. And the design that they came up with is actually very similar to what we ended up launching with. So with us, it was really a month or so of design and kind of back and forth. And then we had a design, we were able to stick with that.
And for us, we had a pretty good first stab with our designer. He came out with a bunch of PDF images. And for the most part, we kept with that. Although we did have these weekly one-hour meetings with him. As we're implementing features and things like that and thinking about things really closely, very, very detailed, granularly, there would be problems that arise, like for example, what happens when, the UI was designed with this specific screen resolution in mind, what happens when you go to a big monitor, where do the tolerances lie, what stretches, what stays fixed, and things like that. And of course, we had to work through those issues along the way, but for the most part, we had a pretty good first stab.
Thank you.
Awesome. Yeah, we're starting to wrap up. We'll take one or two more. Go ahead and answer, and jump up to the mic if you've got a question.
A DRM related question. So it looks like you're using a protected environment. And if you protect your content on stream level, not elementary video stream, but on stream client before demuxing. How did you overcome issue with source being above pump process? As far as I know, Windows application cannot, in Windows Store application, your source is not in pump process, not in protected environment. So if your stream is protected at stream level before it's demuxed, so how have you done it?
Yeah, so I think what he's saying there, and correct me if I'm wrong, is for those of you that implemented DRM technology with your media source itself being outside of the pump, did that create any problems for you? So you have your ITA inside the pump that's protected, but the media source wasn't. Did that create any issues that you had to deal with, or was that not a problem?
I would have to say it wasn't a problem. The main function of our media source is to basically provide an interface between the lower level media foundation environment and our high level C# code, where we actually do the downloading from the Netflix servers. The way Netflix is handling its streams is we actually have them separately. So we're pulling the audio and the video separately. They kind of come through the media foundation source, and it exposes, like every source would, a number of streams, in this case, the audio stream and the video stream. And those are individually protected, so they have the play-ready header on them in this case. And when we hand them off to the pump, or the protected media pathway, the decryption is actually taking place inside the protected environment. So for us, it was mainly an architectural implementation detail of how to get the data from our downloader sort of implementation into the media foundation. And then from that point on, it was a fairly sort of normal game of supply the right information to play ready to decrypt our play ready streams.
Right. It looks like that you decrypt individually audio and video, and your decryption happens after source. As a result, your decryption is not inside the source, it's after the source.
Yeah, so that's correct. They didn't, the data inside the source, no decryption needs to take place inside of their source. So so there was nothing being exposed. It was all the decryption was being done inside the decryptor that was inside the pump.
And just to add to that, I think there's a real benefit in having the media source run outside of the protected process. For example, I can think of just immediately, one is you can actually debug your source very easily. If it's in the protected process, it's a little harder. It's even harder for me, and I've been working on that for a long time. So that's a benefit. Also, if you're running inside the protected process, you need to be a PE licensee. And your binaries have to be signed. You have to agree to follow this compliance and robustness. There's other challenges. For example, you're not allowed to make outgoing HTTP requests from within the protected process. So, unless you really need to decrypt and touch those assets, there's a real benefit in running in the app process.
Well, your decryptor has to run there anyway, so you have to be PE licensee anyway. If you implement DRM, you will have an decryptor there.
If you're implementing a brand new DRM scheme, then yeah, you would have to be running in the PE process. Right.
Sure. Thanks for that question. That's actually a good segue to end this session and mention that we do have a Chalk Talk later on today to follow up with any additional deep questions around the protected media path or any media source questions you might have. I want to offer a very big thank you to our panel for coming today and answering the questions and sharing your experiences with us in the audience. So round of applause for our panel. All right, thanks for coming, guys.